Welcome to the Kona Edge, where you'll discover what the best triathletes in the world do to give them the edge.
Welcome to this edition of the Kona Edge, and it is the Christmas edition. If you are celebrating Christmas, Merry Christmas from all of us here at the Kona Edge. I hope it is a special one, and you with those near and dear to you. I'm pretty chuffed. Got my dads with us, so spending the day with my dads, my wife, and my three kids. So, a very, very special day for us here at the Kona Edge as well. I hope you're having a brilliant day too. We've delved once again into our archives, and I get to share another very cool story with you here on the podcast today, that of Michael Girard. As he joined us probably close on almost 2 years ago since we last spoke. And this is his story. Before we get into that, don't forget your chance to win an entry into an Ironman. All you have to do is head over to thekonaedge.com/win. That's thekonaedge.com/win. You can get into the draw there. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy Michael's story. In the spotlight in the coach's corner today is MP Multisports. Their athlete-coach relationship is what makes MP Multisport unique in the coaching field. Their role is to ensure the coach relationship is evident in all their coaching interactions. MP Multisport coaching involves listening first to understand your needs as an athlete, continuous analyzation by them, and implementation by you. They don't focus on mass-produced training plans or categorize their athletes because no two athletes are the same. There's more to your needs than swim, bike, and run portion of training. Too often, athletes will push through their training laps and miles but forget about the impact in other areas of their lives. To get to your goals, MP Multisport takes a holistic approach to the process, which includes the balance you have in your life, nutrition, core strength, and time management, as well as understanding those needs through communication. To find out more about MP Multisport, head over to the Coach's Corner. Just go to thekonaedge.com/coaching, or alternatively head straight through to their website. It's mpmultisport.com. If you're a coach, or if you have a coaching business and you'd like to be featured in the Coach's Corner, simply head over to that URL. It's thekonaedge.com/coaching and scroll right down to the bottom of the page to get all the details. As we record this, it's a pretty, I don't want to say icy, because it's an uncharacteristically warm winter for you in Michigan at the moment. It's a steamy Cape Town, but it's good to have you on. Welcome.
Yeah, great to be here. Thanks, Brad.
Michael, tell me, let's take a step back and talk about how you got into the sport of triathlon. I mean, were you always pretty active growing up? Were you pretty sporty as a kid?
As a kid, that was out there. I was outdoors, climbing trees, running around the yard, doing those sort of things. Always had some sort of a off-road bicycle of some kind, riding on trails and riding to my friends' houses, you know, a couple miles away. And, yeah, absolutely. Always running, quite a bit, but really never got into competing until high school.
You came from a bit of a swimming and cross-country background. I mean, biking was obviously part of your life, but more for fun. Were you fairly competitive as a swimmer, as a runner, as a teenager?
Yeah, I did pretty well. I like to say I was, you know, I was never quite, you know, a true fish. I didn't do the club swimming, but I started swimming my, I would have been, I think, 14 or 15, started swimming competitively, and, you know, did pretty well. I was on one of the faster relays most of the time, and never qualified for states, but, you know, I grew up in Michigan, so, you know, truthfully, it's one of the swimming states, along with California, Texas, Florida. So, you know, very competitive here, a large high school. So, you know, I did well, and, you know, in a smaller area would have been more more impressive. But, you know, it was enough. It gave me a real solid background, and really did cross country and track and field. And it was much the same. You know, it was well above average, never the best, but it gave me a real solid foundation.
Coming from a multi-sport background, swimming and running, I mean, obviously the natural progression was triathlon, but it didn't happen straight away for you. It was a bit later on in life. When did you first discover the sport of triathlon?
You know, actually, I'll say my first multi-sport event, I did a splash and dash as it was. It was really, really short, very hard race. It was a half-mile run and then a quarter-mile swim, another half-mile run, and no time for transition, so it was all barefoot even, really was the best way to do it. And, yeah, so, this was natural. I said, wow, I'm a good runner. I'm a good swimmer. This is great. So me and a buddy did it, and he was a good runner too, and it was me and him racing for the win, I think, in that. And we were both, 15, 16 years old, and, it was really good fun.
All right, and then, I mean, when you finished high school, you went to college. I mean, did you stay active? Has sport always been part of your life, or did it go to the wayside a bit, sort of in your 20s and maybe later on?
Well, it kind of went on and off. First in college, I think it slipped a little bit. Then I got back into some masters or kind of a club swimming team. And then I got introduced into bicycle racing and really enjoyed that. And I stuck with that really mainly just bicycle racing only, mountain bike, off-road. You're doing crits and road races as well. It was great because you learned bike handling skills really fast and, really became kind of my strength, descending and cornering. I think the only crit I ever won was, it actually was snowing. It was 40, it was like 35 degrees. I guess for the Celsius folks, that's like 3 or 4 Celsius and it's snowing and we're going to get on our bicycles and do a road race. And, I won the race because there's a hairpin corner and I came out of the hairpin and sprinted and, had enough exit speed that I took the win. So it was, it's just really good fun. And you learned how to suffer, you learned how to pace, you learned how to ride real hard and you develop that skill. But from there, I kind of went on and off. I had some motorcycles for a while, went out to some racetracks and rode those real fast. So, dragging a knee at, 200 kilometers an hour is always good fun and learning how to really, push your limits on two wheels a little bit again and, put on some weight. But I think eventually I got back in shape and, it was probably about 5 years ago I got real serious, finally got a true triathlon bike. Have a Speed Concept 7 series, which is now 5 years old and it's totally obsolete, but, I managed to get some pretty good speed out of it. So
have you always been pretty competitive, Michael?
Yeah, I think it's, just natural. It's something, I enjoy winning. It's not to get into too much, personal background stuff. But as a kid, I was kind of picked on, maybe, you look at successful people and, sometimes, not to say bullying is a bad thing, but some of the most successful people are possibly successful because they had a little bit of that chip on their shoulder. So they wanted to kind of prove themselves a little bit. And I think it's always fueled me a little, trying to always want to prove myself, challenge myself, show that I can be successful. I can be better than the person that, got picked on in school and such. So it really does.
Do you think triathlon has given you an outlet for that? I mean, it's one of the sports. I mean, there are lots of sports that have sort of fairly competitive age group sections, but triathlon, I think more than any is very competitive when it comes to age groupers. Do you think it's given you a bit of an outlet to express yourself and to show people that you can do this?
Yeah, absolutely. I was a solid runner, a good swimmer, but if after you get to college and if you're not a professional, it's great being able to put all three sports together. I did well in each of the three sports. And so when you put those together, you go from being, well above average to being, kind of near the front of the pack in terms of triathletes. So, it's just been a great opportunity to leverage that ability.
When did you realize you had some ability in the triathlon sphere that you could be possibly challenging for podiums in your age group?
Well, you just kind of, it's a constant progression. I like to say there was a sudden breakthrough, but if I go back and look at my results, it just was slowly but surely. I do an Olympic and, first one, I did real well. I think it was like a 2 hours and 30 minutes and then the next year it's a 220 and then it's a 215 and a 210, a 205 and you start just chipping away and, you put in a little more time, you train, you adjust your training, you put a little more structure in your training. The biggest breakthrough is I finally decided I was ready. I had done my second half Ironman, and I decided I was ready to race a full. You know, I think a lot of age groupers kind of jump into the challenges, the distance. And that's perfectly fine. That's great. It's definitely a challenge for the distance. But, you know, I'm racing. So my thought is I'm not going to do it until I'm ready to commit the training time to be competitive. So I finally decided I was going to, my wife gave me permission for a year to give this a shot. And I put a structured plan together. I actually read the Triathlete's Training Bible, on a tip from another coach. And put together my training plan, used Training Peaks, put together the weekly schedules, the periodization, and just went about putting together steady, consistent training. And, you put a time goal out there and you always have that in your mind as a goal. But as you go along, you start seeing, okay, you know, I think I can go faster than that. I think I can go a little faster. So pretty quickly the bar starts dropping. And pretty soon you're thinking, okay, it's not going to be about breaking 10 hours. And this, the race I did was Ironman Wisconsin for my first IM. And then pretty soon it's not about breaking 9:45. Now you're thinking, okay, you know, this actually might, looking at previous times, I think I can place probably in the top three. And, you know, that's a realistic goal. And so, you know, I guess kind of going the Ironman Wisconsin story earlier that season, I did Kansas. It was actually my third 70.3. And that was probably my breakthrough race in that I went into that race realizing I had pretty good speed. I had done a half, marathon, just shattered my PR. I think I went to like a 117, 116 or something. I think my previous best was like a 121. So this shattered my PR. Didn't even really taper for it. Just out of the blue, I'm like, wow, I'm running really well. So 3 weeks later, I have Kansas 70.3, and I show up and I ride my pace, ride my numbers, and I come off the bike, and I think I was second or third in the age group. I think actually second age group, and I'm like, wow, this is crazy. Here's guys that they've been top of the age group in the country for years and years, and here I am just 5 minutes behind this one guy and ahead of this other guy. I think the guy in front of me is Adam Zuko. The guy behind me is Scott Ayat, who have been in the top of the age group for years and years. And, it was crazy and kind of neat story. And then I suddenly realized that right behind me is actually Rachel Joyce, because I ended up between the first and second female pros, and we're clocking the exact same pace. And I'm just staying ahead of Scott, where I'm matching him pace for pace. And Kansas, I'm going to miss that course because it had, I think, 8 or 10 opportunities where you double back on the course and you could see your competitor and you could literally take splits and you knew exactly if you were gaining or losing time. And, it was a real exciting race. And I, dug in and put together a great result, shattered my PR and kind of realized, wow, if I can run that pace, then going into Wisconsin, I should have a good shot at, placing top there and, even qualifying for Kona. So I got the agreement from my wife that I could train for a second year if I qualified and had to race in Hawaii. So
brilliant. Why Ironman, Michael? I mean, there's obviously lots of distances. That distance is, and for a lot of people, it's difficult to wrap your head around. But for you, why was the Ironman distance the distance you chose?
Well, it's just that new challenge. I will say, I'm going to admit, I think 70.3 is a more fun race, and it can be equally challenging to go fast because it's definitely a dramatically faster. Ironman's a mixed bag. It's the challenge there is probably being able to put in the amount of training volume and staying healthy and then having a smart and well-executed race. The challenge isn't the speed. It's really a pretty slow race. I mean, really anyone tells you you're spending almost the entire race slowing yourself down, telling yourself don't go too fast until you get somewhere past the halfway point in the run and then you have to start digging in. But it's really a pretty slow race because you put in so much volume that going at that speed that long isn't hard. So it's a different challenge and maybe it's just a competitiveness. Ultimately, all the best athletes are doing IM. That's what they're gunning for. That's what their focus is. So if you want to race the best, then you got to show up and, do well at a regional IM and then qualify for Kona, because that's really where where the top of the competition is, especially with all the expansion Ironman's added to races. The regional races really are not as competitive as they were, I think, 4 or 5 years ago. The top one or two, still incredibly fast, but it gets a lot thinner beyond that point. So you really have to show up to Kona each year if you want to race the absolute best.
As far as the build-up to that first season where you did your first Ironman and then the second season into Kona, were you self-coached or did you seek help?
I actually was self-coached. I it really surprised a lot of people. I even was using there was a virtual coach on Training Peaks. So here I am, you know, I'm just using the virtual coach and just kind of, read through the book, a kind of understanding, you know, the physiology of how I need to build fitness and what some strategies are. But, you know, bottom line is you just put in the consistent work, you put in the volume, you pay attention, getting enough recovery so you can put in the quality, and just, you know, I think if you have some natural athleticism, you've learned over time, you've learned pacing, you've learned how to, you know, listen to your body and know, can I do more? Do I need to back off? If you're kind of, you know, hammering through training a little bit like a robot and saying, boy, I'm just destroyed today, but I'm going to push on anyhow. Well, the truth is you push yourself over the edge, and the next day you're totally destroyed, and you just start digging yourself a hole. So it's, you know, it's really that balance of knowing what you need and how hard you can push yourself. On the other hand, you're only accountable to yourself, and ultimately every athlete is, but having that coach, you know, telling you this is what you should do today, and you're kept accountable, and that you kind of don't want to let your coach down because he knows, okay, to reach your goals, you need to be doing these workouts. And so that's a secondary motivator. So it presents the challenge of having to motivate yourself. But on the other hand, it's, you have the flexibility of doing exactly what you need. So
if you had to go back, would you do it exactly the same way, or would you get a coach?
No, I think I would do it exactly the same way. It ultimately, you know, for me at the time with the budget, I was, you know, allowed by the spouse, you know, and, you know, looking at, it's another challenge on top of the training is, you know, how can I coach myself? And, you know, ultimately I ended up, becoming a coach, you know, kind of through my successes as well. So I taught myself a lot about coaching. I'll say if money was no object, I think I still would have benefited from a coach, and there's more I could have gained and maybe more I could have learned. But on the other hand, there's a sense of self-pride that I was able to accomplish what I did, you know, just relying on myself.
Michael, you mentioned three things in that, just talking about coaching yourself, and I'm gonna say the three things, and I want you to tell me what they mean to you. The first one was consistency, and you mentioned the consistency of training. The second one was quality, and the third one was recovery. How important are those three aspects in training for an Ironman?
I mean, really, like I say, that's you probably pointed out, that's really a triangle of everything. If you're not consistent, you can't progressively build that fitness. It's amazing what just a couple days off, or if you pick up a running injury, I often say it's like a 3-to-1 rule, you know, at minimum. If you lose a week of training, you threw away, if you're off for a week running, you threw away 3 weeks of training. You set yourself back almost a month. So even a very minor injury, you can throw away a whole month of training. So if you get a major injury, you can toss your entire season. Any gains you would have found are thrown away. So it really dictates, especially running, which is so easy to get injured. It really dictates paying attention to that quality, but keeping consistently always being maybe on the top of that triangle. You know, and then recovery, they all really do feed into each other, almost like that recycling symbol, I guess, in a sense. If you recover well, you can put in the quality. And if you pay attention to doing the right amount of quality, not too much, then you can put in the consistency. So it's, you know, I think the mistake people make, you know, especially running, I think triathlon tends to be very run focused in the end, because running is so sensitive. You can't just jump into running 50 miles a week. You can jump right into swimming 20, 30,000 yards a week. You'll be really tired, but you're probably not going to get injured. You can jump into cycling 300, 400 miles in a week. Sounds crazy, but you know, there's amateurs doing it. If you stop running and stop swimming and just bike, you can do it. You'll be totally spent and you'll have to ride most of that very, very easy, but you're not going to get injured. But the challenge with running is that as you get fatigued, your mechanics change. And when your mechanics change, that's when you get injured. I'd even propose that if you talk to elite runners and such and you ask them, hey, when you got that hamstring injury or you got that calf injury or whatever injury you have, I'll bet you were highly fatigued and you're in the middle of a faster interval workout or something. And almost all of them will say, yeah, actually I was. And so, you know, you really got to be careful. Does that one extra set of tempo running or, you know, VO2 intervals or whatever on the track, is that really going to make you faster, or is the risk of getting injured going to put you behind? And within that pyramid or that triangle, are you rested enough to even do that workout? You know, did you just do a hard cycling workout that the day before or that morning, and are your legs too blitzed to put in that kind of quality? So it's always balancing those three of recovery and the quality and putting in the consistency.
It's interesting you talk about the quality. One thing I've picked up chatting to a lot of the age groupers that I chat to is that very few of them, if any of them, go out and do a session just for the sake of doing a session. There's always an outcome. And if a session is a recovery session, that's the outcome. But they don't just go do a session for the sake of doing the session. Are you exactly the same?
Yeah, I'll say so. I will say once I, you know, biking in particular, though, once I get out there and say my goal was to ride, you know, sometimes it is just that I just am going to put in a 90-minute tempo ride. It's not very complicated. It's not a bunch of intervals. It's really quite simple. Ride moderately hard for 90 minutes. But it puts in solid training volume without a lot of fatigue. But if I get out there and pretty quickly 80%, 85% is hard, then I know that workout's done. There's really no point. There's no way I'm going to complete that workout. My legs aren't there. I'm better off converting that into more just an easier workout and then rearrange my schedule and try that workout again. So you have to have some flexibility as well. Yeah, but absolutely. Everything has to still have a purpose, for sure. But, you know, it's putting your weekly plan together and seeing how those pieces fit together, you know, and the best amateurs kind of know, you know, when they can do hard workouts, when the days they're going to have recovery and how they're going to feel. You can't just throw the building blocks together. And you try to put some logical sense together with it.
I asked you a while ago, why Ironman? I'm going to ask you the same question about Kona. Why Kona?
I guess it should be obvious, but like I said, that's where the best athletes are. It's, you know, it's a great destination race. You know, there's probably some places I'd probably rather, you know, I'd say for weather wise, especially the last few years, I think Oahu or somewhere else may have been better climate. It was pretty uncomfortably, hot and humid. You know, it's one thing to be in the lower 80s and be humid, but it was pushing 90 every day there, and the sun was screaming all afternoon, and it was quite the, you know, I guess if nothing else, it's epic. You know, there's little else you can say. No matter what happens, that race is going to be epic. The combination of the course, the weather, and the fact that, you know, all the best in the world are there. So you go out there and have I used to say everyone's pushing themselves. So if you can execute a good race, that by itself, with everyone trying to push themselves just a little harder, you can have a great day, even if, you know, by maybe your own standards, it was only an average race. A lot of people are pushing themselves over the edge there, that's for sure. And it's really an amazing atmosphere, just all the energy, and everyone's there for one purpose, and they all worked hard to get there.
Talk to me about that feeling the first time you arrive on that big island to race in Kona, stepping off the airplane. What does that feel like?
Well, it's hot and humid coming from, Michigan. You try to acclimate, but you realize how warm it's going to be. The airport's outdoors. So right off the bat, it's, you know, welcome to Kona. It's 90 and humid right now. And, but it's funny, you're getting your luggage and you realize at that point, pretty much everyone there's for the race. So, you know, I guess funny story, I'm there getting luggage and, chatting with a guy and, you know, not thinking much of it. I'm like, oh, what's your name? Oh, Tyler. Okay. You know, and so then I'm thinking, okay, so how'd you qualify? I said, well, there's a point system. I'm like, oh, I'm such an idiot. He's a pro. So it was Tyler Butterfield. And we ended up, I believe, finishing fourth or fifth, had a great race there. So it's kind of funny. But there you are. You're waiting for your bicycle to come off the plane just like everyone else. And you're all in the same boat. You know, you all worked hard to get there, and you're all there kind of for the same purpose, to have a great race. So
how intimidating is that?
You know, in some ways, it isn't, you know, maybe because I qualified my first Ironman, it's for me, it's such a privilege. You know, I didn't have to put in the years and years of, you know, trying again and again, trying to qualify. You know, I hadn't been doing this for a decade. So, you know, my expectations are a bit lower. You know, I was going to go in there and put together the best race I could, but, I don't know, never been too, you know, I've never been overly starstruck. I get excited, but on the other hand, I realize they're normal people, and I'm in awe of what they can do. But you know, I kind of, you know, it's a bit surreal in the end. You know, I'm out for, I think, my first swim out and off the pier, and lo and behold, I'm in the shower of all things, and you're rinsing off afterwards, and oh, hey, there's Rachel Joyce again. So, you know, I took a moment to say hi, and because I actually had sent her my race bib after Kansas, and she was kind enough to autograph it. So I thought, you know, I wished her good luck at Kona, and, you know, it's just kind of funny, but they're normal people. Obviously, they have different things they're doing that week, and they're maybe even a bit more focused for sure than I would be. But you know, it's really cool. You earned the right to be there, you know, as much as they did. And they're all, everyone's just, it's just so excited to race and soaking in the atmosphere.
Tell me about your pre-race. Do you have any rituals? Are there certain things you do in the days leading up, the day before? What do you do before an Ironman, particularly before Kona?
You know, it's a pretty progressive taper. So, one things I do in taper is actually my intensity increases a bit, but the duration drops, substantially. So I'm doing some harder intervals and such. Kona was a little different. You know, you only get one opportunity, you know, a few opportunities to be there. So I probably rode my bike a lot more than I probably normally would. But I took opportunity, went out there and rode and got a feel for, you know, what kind of speed I'm seeing in my race kit and, what the weather feels like. So there, because of the climate being so different for me, it was a chance to see what does it feel like. So, you know, I see people run in the morning. I'm like, why are you running in the morning? Get your butt out there in the middle of the hot heat of the afternoon and see what that's like. And you got out there and you're like, wow, it's just amazing. It's 90 some degrees. It's humid and the sun's streaming on you and you're out there running and it's like, wow, this is hot. And, so that's your pre-race, is just trying to get a feel for spending time outdoors, drinking, you know, lots of water still, but getting a feel for what the weather's going to be like. And, you know, I do a lot of mental preparation, just trying to visualize, having a good race. I think you always have to stay positive. You know, you're going to have down times, but visualizing being fast and riding strong at those critical moments and, you know, getting off the bike and having good legs and running well. And, you know, and you visualize yourself, you know, running down that finish chute, knowing you had, you know, maybe a PR, had a great race and finished well. So, you know, and, if you stay positive, it's amazing. You can make a difficult day a true accomplishment. You can just stay positive and race within, you know, what your body gives you that day.
It's very much a mental thing and fighting demons within you on race day. Yes, you're racing against the best in the world. What are some of the strategies you employ? Because we all, like you say, we all go through bad patches and dark times. How do you dig yourself out of one of those during a race when you're really struggling?
Well, it's really important, you know, in training as well as in racing to stay engaged. You know, I'm a big proponent of, I never have an iPod. You know, occasionally I listen to a podcast and a trainer, but it's just an easy spin. I don't know if I'll ever own a Wahoo kicker, for example, one of those, because it dictates the pace for you somewhat. With a conventional trainer, you have to be engaged. You have to make yourself ride at the pace that you need to. So when you get out there on race day, you kind of evaluate, okay, how do my legs feel? What are they going to give me today? I have a target for power, and obviously you use a power meter like most. But in the end, you kind of have to evaluate how you feel and when it makes sense to go, and, you know, when it makes sense to conserve a little bit. So, you know, you kind of, it's just a matter of that staying engaged and staying involved with, you know, what you have to do to accomplish your goals, and, not being overly focused, and, but not saying, you know, I'm going to ride 250 watts no matter what, because I think anyone that says that is probably going to set themselves up for failure.
Talk to me about your first race in Kona and the experience of the race itself. How did your race go? Tell me a little bit about it.
You know, it was a little mixed. You know, I went into it. You know, it happens. You know, I never quite got down to the race weight I wanted. Maybe everyone says that, but I was probably a few pounds heavier than I was at Wisconsin. You know, on the plus side, you know, maybe you're a little strong. You can manage your energy levels better with carrying a little extra weight. But I knew compared to my competition, in particular on the bike, you know, my strengths, I've really dialed in my aerodynamics. So I knew I'm probably more aerodynamic than most of the guys in the field, and I'm a little heavier. My power to weight ratio is worse. So right off the bat, I knew I couldn't hang with them up the hills, but I knew I could pass them on the downhills. So it actually worked really great because it's a very rolling course, extremely rolling course. So every time I came to a hill, in order to stay legal, I let them pass me. So I let people go by me on the hill. I just stuck to whatever wattage, maximum wattage I thought was reasonable. And it allowed me to stay legal. Then I could, on the downhills, I could pass them without having to put any effort. You know, conversely, otherwise you're going to get bunched up and you're having to burn all these matches trying to keep at a legal draft distance. Because ultimately everyone's fast. There's a lot of riders on the road, a lot of people coming out of the water right at that 1 hour mark. So if you have a good strategy, it worked perfectly, and it's so rolling in the early part of the course, I was able to ride almost a steady wattage the whole first 20, 30 miles and really rarely ever had to put in an effort to burn any matches. So really it was exciting. And again, I really like hanging out some corners. So there's some real technical turns early on just coming out of town. And I think looked back at some of those segments. There's a lot of bike splits there. And I think I was among, not that you can search all the amateurs, but I think I was looking at my speed. And, I know Keenley was a little faster on the downhill, and, Dan Stableski, one of the fastest amateur cyclists, he was just, I think, a tenth faster than me, but I think I clocked still at about 40 miles an hour on one of the early segments, and most people are like 32, 35, you know, they're laying on the brakes for that turn, and I'm just hanging it out, and you know, what do you have to lose? I'm still riding within myself, use up the whole road, and it's free speed. You know, if you have good aero and you have good bike handling skills, there's a lot of free speed to be had on any course, and, you know, I took that opportunity and just rode steady. You know, and it's really about the bike on that course. The run's going to be hard, but, you know, you get to the climb to heading up to Javi, and the wind picks up. It was actually good news for me. The wind picked up because I knew I wasn't going to climb with these guys, but we had a solid headwind. So it kind of neutralized the climbers. And, I'm looking down. I'm staying with my wattage, and lo and behold, I'm still gaining ground and making up places. So, I was worried I was going to lose a lot of time there, but I ended up making up some time. And then we turn around to the tailwind, the descent. And, as usual, the wind shifts right at that point, and you don't get a tailwind. You get a cross tailwind. And then pretty soon it's a crosswind, and then pretty soon it's a headwind again. So, as things usually are. And, you know, I didn't get the big speed I was hoping on some of those descents. I don't know if I hardly ever spun out, to be honest. You just didn't have the big speeds I was expecting on those descents. But, just stuck to my wattage, kept sticking to the nutrition, and, you know, late in the bike, it got real hard. It got real hot. I think I looked at my bike computer, and I think it was reading, I thought it was 103 off the pavement. So I don't know what that is in Celsius. Is that 50 Celsius? No. I don't know. It's crazy hot. And it's humid, and they took away the last water station at the airport this year, go figure. And I'm getting towards town. I'm like, man, I'm out of water. This is not how I want to start the run. It worked out okay, but you ended up soft pedaling. I ended up soft pedaling probably the last couple miles through town. Just took it easy, realized there's no more places to gain. You know, about 30 miles out, I'm kind of realizing there's not many people around. So I'm like, hey, I pretty much have ridden myself up towards the front of the race, which is really cool. And I hit transition. Nail my flying dismount, and lo and behold, I'm right in the chute, right behind, of all people, you know, Adam Zuko, I'll mention again, who's one of the fellow coaches, actually the head coach. And so pretty much that was mission accomplished. He's a faster swimmer, so I was like, you know, one of my goals was to ride up to Adam and accomplish that and put on the running shoes. And all I can say is it was hot. You're in transition, and you're – unbelievable how hot you felt, and you got out on the run, and immediately you had to readjust your expectations. You knew whatever pace you thought you could run, even in the heat, you had to knock it down, because you knew there was no way you were going to sustain that in that type of conditions. And it's tough, because I had ridden myself up to, I think, seventh in my age group, and I think probably about top 30 or so amateurs, and you know, it's tough, because then you realize I'm going to get blown away on the run. Just, that's the reality. I'm not a sub nine guy on a hilly, on a challenging course. So it was a bit of dose of reality as guys are just running past me. Although I had to joke with them, because I'm like, I'm watching these guys pass me and they're running like 6:30 pace. And I'm like, there is no way in hell these guys are running sub three in this heat. And no one did. No amateurs ran. I don't think any amateurs ran a sub three. And these guys are flying past me, and I'm like, yep, see you guys later. but they slowed down. I never caught them again, unfortunately, most of them. But it was there was some carnage out there for sure.
were you satisfied with your race? I mean, if you had to go back, would you do anything different the way you approached the race itself in Kona?
You know, it's tough. I thought about that a lot. I didn't have the run I wanted. You know, I think in the end, I did the best I could that day. You know, if anything else, I would have liked to have gone back there maybe 4 or 5 pounds lighter, closer to my weight the previous year. And I think that might have made enough of a difference. I could have gone out there and run more steady, had to walk ended up walking through all the aid stations rather than maybe slowing down to a jog. Although Frodeno walked all the aid stations too, so apparently that's a good strategy. So I didn't feel so bad when I passed him the opposite direction. He was hitting the last aid station, just about to make his turn, back into town. And I'm like, I told another guy next to me, hey, he's walking too. So I guess it's okay for us to walk the aid station. So, but, yeah, it's, yeah, I don't think really, because in the end I could say, well, you know, it'd been cool to, I wanted to bike a little faster, but given the conditions, it was a solid bike split. So if I'd ridden harder, I might have grenaded my legs for the run and ended up going even slower. So, you know, I'd say overall I really executed about the best race I could. If I was to change anything, I think it would have lined up further up front on the swim. You know, listening to others, it turns out a lot of more average swimmers push themselves to the front, which I thought was crap. Really, that's BS. If you're a 105, 110 swimmer, you don't have any business on the front two rows. And they kind of squish the field down a little bit and early on. No one knows why, but they narrowed the start line. And it was kind of mayhem right at the start. You're treading water with about, 2 feet of space. I mean, you're treading water like you're this little midget. Your hands are about 1 inch away from your body. That's all the room you have. And, it was kind of a bummer. I mean, really, ultimately, you got out there, and what happened is this field had to invert itself. There were so many slower swimmers up front. I mean, don't get me wrong. These guys finished near the front, but they were fast runners, slower swimmers, but there was a lot of 110, 105 swimmers right up front, and they had a nice easy swim. The rest of us had to figure out how to get around them. So you got out there, and pretty quickly, there's nowhere to go right, there's nowhere to go left. You know you can go faster than the guy in front of you, but there's no way around them. But then you also realize you'd like to slow down, but you can't, because if you slow down at all, you get run over. So pretty much the pace got dictated really early, and it was past the halfway point before it freed up enough I could actually swim my own pace. So it's I guess I would have liked to swim a little better is the only thing I could probably change, but it could have been a lot worse. A couple of guys, one guy who I've actually finished out of the water with right next to, and I think three or four of the last half and races and when I did Ironman Wisconsin, he swam like a 108 or a 110. I mean, he really had a very slow swim for what he's capable of. So a lot of people just had some awful swims there. There was a pretty tough current coming back, and I think if you weren't in a pack when that current hits you, you were really going to struggle coming back in for sure.
When are you going back, Michael?
Oh, I don't know. I think I told my wife it's definitely a few years off doing Ironman. I'm dropping the training down quite a bit, so I'm just going to do 70.3 for a while. You know, the Worlds for 70.3 is coming back to the States, so, I think I've passed each of the last four times. You know, I've done a 70.3, so I think I'll finally maybe take a slot and maybe give that race a try. Yeah, just fight the draft packs on all I hear about Worlds is how incredibly congested it is, so I don't know if I'm looking forward to that, but it'd be a good challenge and it'd be a fun race. So I think that's my focus for a couple years, and I don't know, it'd be a while. You know, Ironman, if you're it's going to be tough, because by the time I get back to it in a few years, I mean, the reality is I'm probably not going to be as fast as I was, so it's a matter of changing your expectations for the age group you're in, I guess, and it'll be more age group racing than probably overall racing, but it'll still be fun. So it's it'll be exciting to see some of the fast guys that continue to move their way through the age groups. I think you'll still see some of the 45 plus age groups being impressively fast in the coming years. So we'll see.
You've mentioned your wife a couple of times. How do you get that balance right between training, family, and work?
Well, I probably don't. You know, I'm still married, so the good news is I'm doing it well enough to keep that going. But, you know, it's hard. You know, I think I definitely pushed the envelope there. It's really a big time suck for sure. The best thing I try to do is I get a little less sleep. I'm very strategic with the sleep, so I cut myself short during the week, which got to be careful. It can be counterproductive. I'm not quite ready to take the leap of faith thinking that if I get hours sleep every night, that chopping 5-6 hours of training a week is gonna offset that. I don't think that's the case. I think it's somewhere in between the two. But you know, you get up early, you get in a couple hour workout in the morning, and you know, maybe I go for a run at work during lunch, and then a couple days a week I'll get in a workout in the evening. But I try to keep my evenings pretty well free, and you just kind of get real strategic about when you squeeze workouts in. And it's, at some point you cut back on the long rides. You say, okay, if I just get away with a long ride once a month, that's good enough. One of the things I do with running is I run a much higher frequency, and that eliminates the need for an extremely long run. So that kind of shifts that time commitment out a little bit. I don't have a 3-hour run ever. In fact, in training, I think once I've run over 2.5 hours, maybe twice. So I don't do any real extreme long runs, and it's squeezing in workouts where you can in the end. You know, if you only have 45 minutes and your legs feel pretty fresh, and you hop on the trainer and hammer out some hard intervals for 45 minutes. So
brilliant. Michael, thank you so much for your time. I'm going to get you back on to chat a little bit about swimming, cycling and running and a bit about nutrition at another time. But I want to thank you for your time today to tell us a little bit about your story and your journey to Kona. Much appreciated.
All right. Thank you.
Well, that's it for another edition of the Kona Edge. Thank you for listening. And if you enjoyed that and you haven't yet, we'd love it if you left us a review and a rating on iTunes or Stitcher or whatever platform it is that you listen to this podcast on. What that does is it just helps us get into more ear holes, so to speak, and in front of more people. Obviously, the more people who leave us reviews, the higher we get ranked in things like iTunes. It would be hugely appreciated. Leave us an honest review. I'd love to get some feedback, what you think of the show, what we can improve, what you love and what we need to keep on doing. So do be in touch. Don't forget to check out the website as well. Head over to thekonaedge.com. We've got that cool online seminar coming up in just a couple of weeks' time that I can't wait to join you live on. So until next time, from myself, Brad Brown, cheers.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Kona Edge. Don't forget to connect with us on social media. Simply search for The Kona Edge.
I'm guessing that The Kona Edge is not the only podcast you listen to. If you're anything like me, you probably listen to a ton of different podcasts. I think at the moment I have 10 or 15 go-tos that I listen to every single week. And if you listen to a lot of podcasts, at some stage you've probably thought about starting your own. Well, the good news is it's easier than you think. ThePodcastingAcademy.com is giving you the opportunity to get your own podcast started right now. The Podcasting Academy is a 21-day, step-by-step online program that will get you from zero to podcast in just 3 weeks. Right now, thepodcastingacademy.com is offering listeners of The Kona Edge a 25% discount. All you need to do is use the word Kona at checkout to qualify. Head over to thepodcastingacademy.com to find out more.